Most business podcasts today focus on the 1%, the nationally known larger-than-life personalities, entrepreneurs, and celebrities with interesting business stories. Business Exit Stories shares the stories of the other 99% of unheralded entrepreneurs that own successful companies in manufacturing, retail, logistics, telecommunications, construction, food service, and in every imaginable type of business in every state and city around the country. These are the stories told by the deal makers that facilitate exits. These are the mergers and acquisition specialists, business brokerages, financial and wealth planners, CPAs, appraisers, and attorneys. By listening to their stories, you'll learn what the entrepreneurs and business owners they represent did right and what they did wrong when it comes to exiting their business through a sale or a merger. In fact, you'll not only learn how they avoided disastrous exits, but how they positioned their companies for an out-of-the-ballpark home run when they exited their business. And here's your host, Marvin L. Storm.
Today we have with us John Tichich. John is a business broker with a specialty in manufacturing-oriented businesses. John shares with us several stories that have some great takeaways. One of the stories he shares on today's podcast is a franchise dry cleaning retail business. You might be asking yourself, I thought you said he specialized in manufacturing businesses. Well, that's true. However, if you think about it, dry cleaning has a manufacturing-like component to it, especially when a dry cleaning business has remote retail satellite locations with a processing plant for cleaning the garments that are located elsewhere. In his first story, John shares how a dry cleaning franchise agreement completely derailed a sales transaction. Listen closely as John explains how the terms of that franchise agreement made a huge difference in the cash required for a down payment with an SBA loan that was a part of the financing of that sale, and how the terms of the franchise agreement cratered the deal. In another transaction, he shares how the seller of a medical device manufacturing company had three offers on the table, and the seller actually took the lowest offer versus the highest offering price, and the reasons why the seller did this. Finally, John shares how a business that had one customer that represented a whopping 72% of sales revenue actually got sold. In most cases, a company with this much revenue concentration would never get funded by a bank because lenders generally will not finance a transaction with such a high concentration of revenue in one customer. John shares with us how this deal got done. This is Marvin L. Storm of the Business Exit Stories podcast. Today, you're here with John Tichich. John, would you take a few minutes and introduce yourself?
Yeah, thanks, Marv. John Tichich. I work for Sunbelt Midwest, based out of Minneapolis. We have six offices in five states. We have Minneapolis, St. Paul, Milwaukee, Chicago. We recently acquired Las Vegas and recently acquired Fargo. So we have six offices in five states. My experience is primarily in manufacturing, and I've been a business broker for almost 6 years now.
Okay, great. So you indicated you have a very specific niche that you focus on in the manufacturing arena. Is that correct?
That's correct. I joined a local association, a manufacturing association called the Minnesota Precision Manufacturers Association. And so I'm very in tune with new technologies in the industry and best practices, lean manufacturing, stuff like that. So I'm very familiar with manufacturing. And early on in my brokerage career, I happened to sell a few manufacturing companies, and they were great companies to represent. And in Minnesota here, we have a robust database of buyers that are looking to own their own manufacturing company and would rather buy one versus build one, because it can be quite costly to build a manufacturing company given the cost of the equipment that these companies use and the type of talent that's required to operate these machines. So Early on, I established a foothold in this industry, and out of the 30 of us here in our firm, I would say I'm one of the go-to advisors for business owners who own manufacturing companies.
All right. Well, why don't you take a few minutes and share a transaction that you've been involved in that didn't go all that well?
Sure, Marv. Thanks. So the first transaction that I'd like to discuss is a Martinizing dry cleaner that was three locations in the Twin Cities. And the Perry, the seller or the owner of those three locations, was looking to transfer all three locations and move on to a different business venture that a friend had presented. So he wanted to liquidate the three locations, transfer them to a buyer, and invest that money into a new opportunity. And so a couple of things that we learned in this particular situation is that with franchises, anytime you're transferring a franchise to a third party or a buyer, Marv, as you well know, you want to understand the costs that are associated with this transfer.
Martinizing Dry Cleaners is a large national franchise.
Correct. Correct. At one point, they were the largest in the country, and since they still might be the largest. I'm not sure on that, but at one point they had several hundred locations nationwide and a couple dozen in the Twin City area. And Perry owned three of the top producing locations in the state at the time. And he was in a pretty good position to sell them. And so one of the things that we'll do on the front end is figure out, you know, what is it going to cost the buyer to acquire these three locations, not only from a down payment standpoint, but from an initial investment required by the franchisor. And so I asked Perry to investigate with the franchisor and ask him what it would cost to transfer the three locations. And the cost that the franchisor had disclosed to us to transfer the three locations was $6,000 total. And they were right. It ended up being $6,000, but we were not aware that there were additional costs that the buyer would have to pay the franchisor to acquire these three locations. And so the additional costs were a grand opening fee, which was $15,000 per location, totaling $45,000 for all three. And then there was also an initial franchise fee, that typically doesn't come along with a transfer, but in this case it did. And that was another $15,000 per location. And so when we went to market, part of our advertising or marketing package disclosed that the cost to the buyer, in addition to the price of the business, would be $6,000 paid to the franchisor. Once we found a buyer and introduced that buyer to the franchisor, we learned that there were additional costs to the tune of $90,000.
And were all of these costs outlined in the franchise agreement?
So they were not outlined in the franchise agreement that the seller was under. Okay, so I reviewed that franchise agreement, and those costs were not in his agreement at the time he signed it, which had been 15 years prior to us selling the locations. And so the franchisor had added some costs into their new agreement that would impact the buyer's overall investment. And so when we went to market, we had thought that the cost to the buyer to acquire these three locations would be $6,000. It ended up being $96,000, which impacted the economics of the transaction. So the buyer has an initial down payment that he needs to invest to acquire the business. And in this particular case, it was about $75,000 that he needed to invest to acquire the business. And then he was going to finance the rest through an SBA loan. And then it turned out that he needed to come up with another $96,000 to cover the costs that the franchisor required be paid. And so what that did, Marv, is that, you know, reduced the buyer's buying power, as I call it, because instead of $75,000, he needed about $165,000, which he was not comfortable spending. So after we learned that, we found out that the buyer was not interested in acquiring all three locations, and he really focused on one of the three locations that was in a great location. Thankfully, two of the three locations actually had equipment that could clean these garments. And then there was a third location that was a satellite, just retail pickup and drop off. And so it turns out that we had the luxury of just selling one of the locations and having the seller retain the other two and still have the ability to clean the garments himself and service that satellite location that did not have any cleaning equipment.
So in this case, the seller retained the one cleaning plant plus the satellite location and sold off another location that had a cleaning plant.
Correct. And so once we arrived at that conclusion that that was going to be the direction that we ultimately took, was to sell off one of the three locations, we needed to accurately value that one location. And that location happened to be cleaning the garments for the satellite location that did not have the capabilities to clean the garments itself. And so one of the other issues that we encountered in this transaction was that the cleaning location, the cleaning facility was not properly charging the satellite location for costs associated with cleaning the garments. So in other words, the satellite location seemed to be very profitable because they were not being charged for actually cleaning the garments. And the same is true for the cleaning facility, the production facility. Their cash flow was significantly less because they were not making a profit on the garments being brought in from the satellite location. And so the financials that each location, they each had separate financials, and that was helpful. But the thing that didn't help us was that the costs associated to cleaning the garments were not allocated properly by the production facility and the satellite facility. And so what we had to do, Marv, was we had to bring in the seller's accountant to normalize the financials for all three locations, but specifically the production facility that the buyer was going to acquire. And so when we originally looked at the financials of the production facility, the net profit margin was quite low. And then after we normalized the financials and accounted and allocated the expenses that the satellite location should have been paying the production facility, once we normalized all of that and accounted for the expenses properly, the net profit margin was in line with industry averages, and the buyer was able to get comfortable with those numbers, and we were able to fairly value that location.
My experience is that when you have a situation where there are multiple locations, it's not unusual for the owner of the business to account for all of the locations out of one central bank account. Although they may, as you said, have separate financial statements, the allocations, which are not all that important, should be, but aren't always at all important to the owner of the business, because they have a big picture view of what's going on. And because they work in the business every day, they really have a good handle on what the costs are. But from a long-term strategic point of view, having those allocations where you may in fact be selling those businesses at some point in time separately, it's really important to have those cost allocations taken into account early in the process, never mind the ability to look at each location and see what the real profitability is for those locations, and do a much more financially oriented analysis and tracking key metrics. But in this situation, they went back and normalized everything, so they actually had that information when the buyer needed to see it. It's just a real challenge sometimes to pull all that information together, and can be really expensive.
You're absolutely right. And actually, when the seller, when Perry approached me to sell, he only wanted... He came to me and wanted to sell one or two of the three locations, because one of the locations was, pretty efficient on its own without, Perry spending much time in that location. So he thought, hey, I can sell two of these locations, keep the third one, and still be able to move on to this next opportunity, because he wasn't required to, on the day-to-day operations of one of the locations, because he had key management in place. And so what I had told Perry is, I said, that's a great idea. However, I think because the expenses and profits are properly allocated, it would be very challenging to do that. And so we discussed the challenges that would come with breaking apart, you know, one or two of the three and retaining one or two, and decided we didn't want to do that. So we listed all three of them for sale. And that way we didn't have to normalize the numbers, which his accountant ultimately ended up doing. But it cost him some money to have his accountant do that. And it took up a lot of time in due diligence. And as any experienced business broker will tell you, deals don't age well, meaning the longer it takes, the less likely they are to execute. And so that's why we ultimately listed all three locations. But at the end, we sold one and still had to normalize the numbers and account for all the expenses and income properly to accurately value each specific location.
Okay, in this situation too, seems like the takeaway here is that you're going to have to normalize expenses and account for locations, especially in a multi-location type of business, as this person had, this owner had, and you might as well do it from the get-go versus trying to recreate those normalized financial statements down the road. The other big takeaway here is that when you're dealing in a franchise environment, you know, the franchise agreement does really dictate how those agreements are transferred. And in this particular case, what happened apparently is that the franchisor had an original agreement in place that had specific terms on transfer, and those terms were negotiated and agreed to. But the new agreement, most franchise agreements are not assignable. Most franchisors will require that a new franchise agreement is executed upon transfer. They will allow the franchise agreements to be transferred, but the new buyer has to sign a new franchise agreement and start that term over. And in this case, the new franchise agreement required provisions for grand opening and an initial franchise fee to be paid, which isn't the case in a lot of transfers and franchise agreements. Those fees can be waived. But in this situation, they weren't waived. And the obligation of the new buyer was substantial. As you said, almost $100,000 more in franchise fees paying to the franchisor that made it impractical for the buyer to buy all three locations. Interestingly enough, in this particular situation, John, was the advertising fees and royalty fees also increased when they signed the new franchise agreement?
Yeah, actually, the seller's franchise agreement was under at a lower rate for a royalty percentage and a marketing and advertising percentage than the new agreement. So the new franchise agreement had a higher royalty rate, it had a higher marketing and advertising rate, and then it also had some unexpected expenses that came with the transfer to a new owner. And so that was something we discovered in the due diligence process. And so that's something that anybody, any business owner who owns a franchise especially, or not only a franchise, but needs third-party consent, they need to understand the specifics of those consents and transfers.
Well, in this situation, I think franchise companies, they want to create a standard uniform agreement. That's what franchising is all about. And it's very typical that agreements are not transferred. The old agreement is not transferred and new ones have to be executed. So if you are looking at either selling or buying a franchise, I guess the takeaway from this story is that, you know, you need to really understand what those terms and provisions are before going to market. Well, John, let's move on to another story, maybe more in the manufacturing area, because that's your area of expertise.
Yeah. So this next transaction or story is about a Minnesota-based distributor of retractable screens. And so this was an exclusive distributor for a manufacturing company that produced retractable screens. And so here again, we have a company that sells and installs retractable screens for a manufacturer, which is the third party consent here again. And so you ran into a couple issues on this one. It ultimately sold, but it wasn't with the original buyer that made a full price offer. And so what happened, Marv, is the buyer and seller came to an agreement. The agreement was contingent, of course, on your normal due diligence stuff, reviewing the financials, getting a lease in place, getting the SBA loan, but then also it was contingent on getting acceptable terms with the manufacturer who made the products that they were selling and installing. And so throughout the due diligence process, we learned that the seller's financials were antiquated, to say the least. They were using a general ledger, a handwritten general ledger, as their profit and loss statement, which presented some delays and challenges for the buyer to really get comfortable with the financials. But then it also included a contingency that the buyer gets an acceptable agreement from the manufacturer of these retractable screens. And so the seller had an agreement with the manufacturer that they had a pricing agreement, and then a term in that agreement that was a 3-year term, and that they only had 1 year left on. So they had 1 year remaining on their agreement to do business with this manufacturer. And so when the buyer was, let me back up a second. So the seller, we recommended to the seller for confidentiality reasons that they do not disclose to the manufacturer that they were going to sell the company. And there's a number of reasons why we recommended that, but confidentiality is obviously important in these transactions, and the less people know, the better. And so we recommended to our client to not disclose this until we had an agreement in place with a buyer. And so once we had an agreement in place with a buyer who was financially qualified and also had the experience and background to successfully take over the business, we introduced him to the manufacturer. And the manufacturer was not based in the U.S., and so they were not familiar with... They were based in Canada. They are based in Canada. And so they're not familiar with SBA loans. Well, SBA loans are quite attractive when you're selling a company for a couple of reasons. First reason is the seller typically gets more cash at closing. They get roughly, 90% cash at closing with SBA financing. And then the other reason is that the buyer can leverage their dollar. And in most SBA loans, 7A loans, they can acquire a business for 10% of the purchase price. So easy math, let's say the business is worth $1 million. The buyer can acquire it for $100,000. Okay, so that's quite attractive. In Canada, they don't have SBA because SBA is a U.S. government program. And in Canada, banks in general typically are not involved in these transactions. And so a typical transaction in Canada, the buyer will put down 30 to 40% of their own money, and the seller will finance the balance. And so that's what they were used to seeing when these distributors would sell to a new owner.
So it sounds like the manufacturer, being in Canada, most of their business obviously would have started out in Canada, Canada being, rather inclement. And so weather screens are in high demand up there. So their business started in Canada. And when they expanded into the U.S., they weren't really familiar with how transactions on a sales side took place. And this may have been actually unusual for them. So they really were not familiar with how different financing terms work.
In this particular transaction, the manufacturing company was a little nervous about how much money the buyer was borrowing, and that they were maybe taking on a little bit too much debt. Okay. And it's smart of them to think of that, right? Because they want to make sure that their distributors are able to operate the business and invest in the business to grow it, to buy more of their product. And so when they found out how much debt this particular buyer would be taking on in this transaction, they got a little nervous.
Well, they got nervous because that's not traditionally what happens in Canada. When you have 50, 60% debt, to equity, here it's 90-10. They just didn't understand that's the way business is done here.
You're absolutely right. And so one of the things we actually did is we introduced them to one of the top SBA lenders in the country, and had them explain that this is a normal transaction, that the buyer was not taking on an excessive amount of debt by SBA standards. And even so, they still were very uncomfortable with the way the transaction was set up, and specifically how much debt the buyer would be taking on and have to service post closing.
So how did all this work out then?
So this actually did not work out with this buyer. The buyer had some back and forth with the manufacturing company, and neither side were really willing to compromise. And needless to say, the relationship with the potential buyer was damaged with the manufacturer, and vice versa. And so not only did the buyer disagree with their opinion on how much debt he should be taking on, but the manufacturing company would not grant him an acceptable term for his agreement. So they would only give him a 1-year term, saying, hey, we're only guaranteeing you 1 year of supplies to operate your business, essentially is what they were saying. And obviously that presents quite a bit of risk.
And the reason they're probably doing this is they wanted to protect themselves in case the new owner couldn't service the debt and they weren't locked into a long-term situation.
That's absolutely right. And so if he was unable to service the debt and ultimately the business went sideways, then they could find a new distributor. And that obviously wasn't appealing to the buyer nor the bank that the buyer was going to borrow from. And so that transaction ultimately closed, but not with this buyer. So after this buyer realized that it wasn't going to work out, the relationship with him and the manufacturer was damaged, he decided to back out. After that, we asked the manufacturer to reconsider their approval process, to have a formal letter in place with specific requirements that a buyer needed to meet from a financial standpoint and an experience standpoint. Once we laid all that out, we were able to find a new buyer that ultimately purchased the business, but it took a lot longer than we had originally anticipated. And, you know, anytime you have a third party involved that requires, and that the transaction requires their approval, you need to understand all their requirements. And unfortunately, in this particular case, that third party did not have a formal approval process in place by the time they were aware that this distributor was selling. And then after they formally put an approval process in place and we found a buyer that met those requirements, and the transaction closed, but it took a lot more time and it actually sold for a little bit less than the original buyer was going to pay. So it cost the seller a little bit of money and time.
So the big takeaway from this transaction appears to be get those criteria out of the way as much as you can so that you can know what the terms of the transfer are going to entail. And it's kind of hard to do sometimes when you have a distributor in this case that hadn't dealt in the U.S. and didn't really understand. It's kind of hard to predict how all that's going to roll out.
Right.
Well, why don't we move on to some stories that and transactions you've been involved in that have worked out well.
Sure. So the first one I want to talk about was called Star Manufacturing, and that's a small manufacturing company based in the Twin Cities. And the sellers were Tom and Sharon. And they had started the company from scratch and built it up to a nice profitable business with decent machines and equipment and an outstanding base of employees. They specialized in manufacturing prototypes and fixtures, primarily for medical device companies. The company had very steady sales, very steady profits, had a very diverse customer base. So there's no customer concentration issues with this one. It was very attractive. It was a really well-positioned company for the market. It was in a category that has a lot of demand in this in this area. And when we went to market, we ultimately found three buyers that all submitted offers around the same time.
In this situation, when you brought the buyers to the table, they were attracted to it because of the way the business was organized.
The way it was organized, not only from a workflow standpoint in the production facility, but the way it was organized, the employee base, the customer base, and the diverse customer base, I should say. Let me say that again. So, yes, the way the company was organized was quite attractive for those three things. They had a diverse customer base. They didn't require any capital improvements to the equipment or the facility, and they had a loyal employee roster, many of whom had been around with the company for, you know, 10 plus years.
And were the financials in good shape?
The financials were in good shape. It wasn't growing, it wasn't declining. It was just very steady year over year with really stable revenue, really stable cash flow. And so the numbers that we were advertising, that the company was producing, was very easy for a buyer and a bank to get comfortable with. Sometimes you have businesses that are growing, you know, by 10, 20% year over year, and we're trying to value the business based on the most recent 1 or 2 years to maximize the value. In this case, you could do a 3-year average or a 5-year average for that matter, and have the same valuation as if you were valuing the business on 1 or 2 years. So it was very steady. So there was three buyers that were interested. There were two of them were individual buyers who had a job, had a nice retirement savings that they were going to leverage to finance the purchase. And then the third one was more of a strategic buyer or another manufacturing company that was really attracted to the customer base and the employees. So we had three buyers. They all made contingent offers, and they were all very similar from a pricing and term standpoint. And so anytime you have multiple offers on the table at the same time, you really need to not only figure out which one's the best for the seller from a money standpoint, but also figure out which buyer's the best from a capability standpoint. And so I'll get to that in a minute. But what we did is once we had the three offers, all very comparable, we invited the three buyers. We let them know that there was multiple offers. And so what we did is we invited the three buyers to do their financial due diligence. And so one thing I should point out, Marv, is when we go to market, part of the profile does not include detailed financials. So we don't share tax returns with buyers. We don't share profit and loss statements or balance sheets with buyers prior to the due diligence period. And so each one of these offers had a contingency on reviewing and approving the seller's or the company's financials and records. And so after we got the three offers, we asked the three buyers to review the company's financials and records and then resubmit an offer. And so we shared the same information with all three buyers. And then all three of them made another offer without a contingency that pertained to reviewing the company's financials. And so that did a couple things for us. It sped the due diligence process up a little bit, because that's typically something that is time consuming, is explaining the financials to the buyer so they understand it and are comfortable with it. And then it also reduced the percentage that a buyer would try to renegotiate based on some discrepancy in the cash flow that we are advertising compared to the cash flow that they or their accountants calculate. And so that process ultimately got the buyer through due diligence faster, got them to the closing table faster, and reduced the opportunity for the buyer to renegotiate the price based on the actual detailed financials. And so once the three buyers resubmitted their final offer, we compared the three and I asked my clients who they liked the best and which offer they liked the best. And they ultimately decided to take the lowest bid because they liked that buyer the most. And it was an individual buyer who was a consultant for manufacturing companies. And so he was really familiar with the industry. They thought his personality would mesh well with the employees, their current customer base, and their vendors and suppliers. So they thought from a personality standpoint, from a character standpoint, that the buyer was very well suited to take over the business, even though his bid from a price standpoint and a cash at close standpoint was the least, it was the lowest. So that was that I found really interesting because all three buyers were great. And, you know, by my judgment, I would qualify each one of them equally to take over the business. But the sellers thought that one in particular was best suited from a background and a personality standpoint, that's the one they selected. So I thought that was one that was unique. I mean, you don't get three offers on a business all at once, you know, every day. And so sometimes as a broker, you wonder how to handle that process. And I thought by asking them to do their financial due diligence first, resubmit an offer, and then let them know that the sellers will decide after they do that, I thought that worked quite well. And it's actually something that I've used on transactions that occurred after that.
Well, I guess the big takeaway is that actual process that you followed on having multiple buyers be given the same information and perform their financial due diligence and come back with their best offer, and that you will evaluate the offers at the time and make a selection on how you're going to move forward.
Yeah.
That's a good takeaway. Well, one last story. John, can you share a brief story about another transaction that went really well for you?
Yeah, so this one, Marv, was another Minnesota-based manufacturing company. The manufacturing company that we sold had one customer that was 72% of the overall revenue. And that can be very difficult to get a buyer and a bank comfortable with. So what we did, Mar, is we had the business owner, the seller, put together a one-page summary of his relationship with this customer. And not only did we do that, we allowed the buyer access to this customer, meaning the buyer could sit down with the customer and prior to closing and discuss the future of the business with this customer. And so after all the due diligence was done, we sat the buyer down with their top customer over lunch, and this customer had reassured the buyer that they were going to continue to do business with this company at the same rate, if not a higher rate. And so by providing a summary of their relationship and allowing access to this customer prior to closing, we think that made the buyer quite comfortable with that relationship and was critical to the outcome, which was selling the business and sending the seller into retirement. So those were a couple things that we thought worked out really well. for both parties.
So in this case, is it traditional in the manufacturing arena for a concentration of one customer to be there?
It is. It is. It's not typical to have one customer that is 70%+ of the overall revenue. But with manufacturing companies, a lot of times the manufacturing companies will have, you know, maybe 30% or 40% with their top customer, and then it diversifies from there. But pretty rare to see such a heavy concentration with one customer.
Share with us how a bank would view concentration of this amount with one customer.
So most SBA preferred lenders will decline financing a transaction that includes more than 30% with one customer. But in this case, we actually used an SBA lender that financed the transaction 10 years ago when the seller acquired it. So we got lucky with the bank and their comfort with the overall transaction.
So as a general rule, I guess the best practice would be if you are in a manufacturing company, you should really bend over backwards to get that concentration with one customer down.
Yeah.
Because it's going to be very difficult. In this case, the same bank and SBA group financed the transaction because they had financed it before. But if you hadn't had that circumstance, it would have probably been very difficult, if not impossible, to complete this transaction.
Yeah, I agree. Anyone who owns a manufacturing company or any business for that matter that has one customer over 30%, I think your advice is spot on, and try to diversify that customer base as much as possible to bring down your top customer under that 30% threshold.
Well, this has been great, John. Well, for those who want to reach out and get a hold of you if they had more questions and had specific interest in manufacturing brokerage, how would they get a hold of you?
Yeah, so they can find me on our company's website, sunbeltmidwest.com. Sun in the sky, belt around your waist, midwest.com. John Tichich, sunbeltmidwest.com.
All right. Well, thank you for taking the time. Until next time, when we'll have more business exit stories, we'll see you later.
Appreciate it, Marv. Thank you.
Join us on our next episode when our guests will share more stories of how entrepreneurs, founders, and business owners have exited their businesses and learn about what to avoid and what you need to do to successfully position your business for a successful exit. If you enjoyed this podcast, take a minute to give us a rating on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts so aspiring entrepreneurs everywhere can find us. If you wish to reach out to any of our guests, please visit our website at www.businessexitstories.com, where you can find more information. Join us next time for more Business Exit Stories.